This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
The DREAM Act, legislation that would allow the children of undocumented immigrants to legally remain in the U.S. and gain resident status, has been introduced into both houses of Congress at various times in various forms since 2001. It is yet to pass or even be voted on in the Senate. President Obama has put some aspects of the act into effect with executive orders, but there are students around the country who still hope the full act will someday become law.
That's what's keeping me going, and that's what I will continue fighting for.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from a potential dreamer. We'll also explore the lives of the children of refugees in the U.S., get a report on the growing problem of sexual assault on college campuses, and spend a revolutionary academic minute. I'm Bob Barrett. And this is The Best of Our Knowledge. One in every 50 students who graduated high school last year were undocumented immigrants. Undocumented students cannot apply for federal financial aid or many loans and scholarships. Those who do make it through college can't legally work in the U.S. The DREAM Act, which has been introduced in various forms in Congress, would allow undocumented students who meet certain requirements to get a path to citizenship if they earn a college degree or serve 2 years in the military. Molly Freed profiles the DREAM Act and one student who has fought for its passage, Carlos Padilla, who graduated from high school in Seattle in 2010.
A summary of the DREAM Act, as written on the DREAMact.info website. The purpose of the Development, Relief, and Education of Alien Minors Act, also called the DREAM Act, is to help those individuals who meet certain requirements have an opportunity to enlist in the military or go to college.
Yeah, my name is Roberta Lindemann, and I'm a teacher for Seattle Public Schools at Chief South High School in a program called Proyecto Saber. This is a program that supports Latino students throughout their 4 years in high school and also prepares them for a plan for after high school. So to me, really, the DREAM Act is the hope for many of the undocumented students that are here in Seattle, in the state of Washington, throughout the country, because it would support these young people, many of them who've been here since they were very, very young. For them, it's going to say that, yeah, they too have the same opportunities and that there truly is equality in this country.
The following is a list of specific requirements one would need in order to qualify for the current version of the DREAM Act. 1. The applicant must be between the ages of 12 and 35 at the time of application.
My name is Carlos Padilla. I am 18 years old. I just recently graduated from Chief South High School, and I will be attending the University of Washington, where I will be majoring in political science and business administration, and then continue into law school to become a civil rights lawyer. And I'm undocumented.
2. The applicant must have entered the United States before the age of 16.
So many people ask me how I came to the U.S. Well, the reality is that I can't remember. I was 2 years old. Our family came from Jalisco, Mexico. From there, we moved to East L.A., California. I remember my mom being in the living room, and she had just came back from working. And then I saw her that she started to cry. And as a kid, seeing your parent go through that was really hurtful. I remember running to her and telling her, you know, that I loved her and I appreciated all she did. And I told her, you know, that as soon as I could, I would grow up and help her out as much as I can. I wanted to fight for her, you know, get my education and be able to help her out financially.
3. The applicant must have been present in the United States for at least 5 consecutive years prior to the enactment of the bill.
But, you know, once I realized what being undocumented meant for me, it kind of, in a way, put my hopes and dreams down. Just the fact that I knew that if I educated myself and at the end, the best job I could get was probably a McDonald's job or working in the fields, you know, it really didn't inspire me. It didn't really inspire me to get educated or go to college. So during that time when I was in like late middle school, I unfortunately started hanging around with the wrong type of crowd. You know, I couldn't really hope for anything better. So I found a family, I guess, in that kind of crowd. So at the end of my middle school, my family realized that the place where we were living at was not the best place to live at for a kid like me. And we moved to Seattle, Washington around 5 years ago.
4. The applicant must have graduated from a United States high school or have obtained a GED or have been accepted into an institution of higher education.
When I moved to Seattle, Washington, it was a completely different environment, something that completely changed my life to the for the better. Graduation came, and in a way, it was the happiest, also the saddest day of my life. The reason why I said it was the happiest was, of course, you know, I had done all my family had asked me to, I had done all society had asked me to graduate from high school. I felt really proud of myself just doing all the leadership roles that I took once I was in high school. But the saddest thing was that the reason why I did it in a way was for the, you know, the role model that my mom had set for me to work hard. And unfortunately, she wasn't able to be part of my graduation because just 2 years ago, her brother died. So she had to go back to Mexico. It's going to be 3 years almost now that I haven't seen her. So I remember before the actual ceremony, I cried a little bit because I was really kind of mad, sad. Just a whole bunch of emotions came through me that, you know, I couldn't explain at that time. I knew that, you know, she was really proud of me, and that's what kept me going. Being able to say that I graduated on time, and even though I'm undocumented, I got accepted to a four-year university. That's what, you know, made me realize that, you know, hey, I shouldn't be so sad, because I know that if I continue pushing myself, regardless if my mom is here or not, I will be able to see her pretty soon if, you know, my dream becomes a reality. So that's what's keeping me going, and that's what I will continue fighting for.
5. Applicant must have good moral character.
You know, I've been all over Washington just educating the community of what the Dream Act really is. I've created what is called today the Washington Dream Act Coalition. I just came from a trip to Washington, D.C., where we took 12 of our members to D.C. in order for them to speak to our congressional representatives. During this trip, I met one of the members that was part of the coalition. And on the first day that we went to D.C., we had a story sharing event. And he, you know, told us, oh, I never cry. You know, I've always tried to be, you know, the hard man, just so that my family wouldn't have to know that I've, you know, I felt sad for things that we're going through. He had never spoken to a representative before. When we went to meet the congressional representative, he started to cry. And, you know, I knew why he was crying. Just at that moment, it really hit him, and how he was having so many hardships continuing with his education just for the simple fact that he didn't have the Social Security. And you could only get a Social Security number if you're a legal resident of this country. You know, those are 9-digit numbers that can really determine someone's life, either they continue educating themselves or they don't.
If you have met all those requirements and can prove it, once the DREAM Act passes, you will be able to do the following. Enroll in an institution of higher education.
If the DREAM Act is passed, the promise I made my mother will become a reality about becoming a lawyer. Not just that, but the fact that I will be able to continue my education without having any more obstacles. I've always wanted to make a nonprofit organization to help the youth in order to continue their education. And if the DREAM Act passes, this would allow me to be able to do that.
Once 5.5 years of the 6 years have passed, the individual will then be able to apply for
legal. And so the passage of the DREAM Act for many of these youth is going to provide them with more motivation to not only do well in high school, but then to go on to college. As a teacher personally, with passage of the DREAM Act, I can truly look into their eyes and tell them, yes, of course you need to go to college, and of course you're going to get a degree from the university, because when that happens for them, then they can make their contribution back to their communities, which so many of them want to do, and they just want to be able to do their part.
And that report came to us from producer and reporter Molly Freed. Once a family of refugees has been in the United States for a while, the children often become ambassadors to the outside world. It's the kids who have to translate for their parents and deal with all the bureaucracy of life, from hospitals to schools to immigration offices. Reporter Jessica Partnow looks into what the refugee experience is like for the children.
Birch Creek is a huge public housing complex in East Hill, a couple of miles from downtown Kent. Just over 1,000 people live here. The place was completely renovated in 2010, and the streets are Disneyland clean. The townhouses all have pretty little patios and yards. More than half of the people who live here are immigrants and refugees from all over the world. There's a community center where a Polynesian dance troupe practices every week. 74% of the kids here live in homes where English is a second language. At 3:30 on school days, kids pour into the gym and the computer lab for a few quick games before being shuffled upstairs for homework help.
We, on any given day, we have students from Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, Iran, Iraq.
Rosalind Kaji runs a tutoring program at Birch Creek.
Turkey, Moldova, Russia, the Ukraine, Mexico, Thailand, Vietnam.
Most of Rosalind's students are refugees or recent immigrants.
I remember a couple weeks ago we stopped and counted. We were going around the table talking about how to say hello in our language, and we realized that there was 11 different languages being spoken at one tutoring table.
A lot of Rosalind's job is helping kids and parents navigate new systems. For some families, the schools here are just a little different from the ones back home. It's like moving to a new state. For others, coming from conflict zones or some refugee camps, just having school every day is new.
So a lot of times the parents will come in and they don't quite know how to say it, but I can tell. I'm like, all right, cool. Their kid's here and they want them to study, so I'll make that happen for them.
Liz Peter came to Birch Creek for tutoring when she was in high school. Now she's 19, just finishing her second year of college. She lives an hour away in Shoreline, but she tries to come back every Tuesday and Thursday to help out. She recently tutored a boy from Puerto Rico.
He was asking me where I was from, and I was like, I'm from Sudan. He's like, oh yeah, that's in Africa. That's why Kenya. It's like, how do you know that? You're only like 8.
Liz was born in southern Sudan. Her family moved to a refugee camp in Kenya when she was a year old. They came to the U.S. as refugees the next year, in 1993. Today, a little knot of 10 and 12-year-old girls in headscarves is crowding around Liz as tutoring gets started.
You can come over here and I can help you.
Liz seems like a natural, joking around about math homework with a fifth grader from Somalia.
I haven't done math by hand in such a long time.
Okay, then what's 6 times 5?
6 times 5 is 30.
Liz uses her iPhone to double-check the math.
So 38 times 45. How would you start doing that?
Wait for it.
Liz is fun to be around. She's happy and energetic. She's proud of her life. Watching her tutor, it's hard to believe that she almost didn't finish high school.
I was just tired of school, same thing every day. And I felt like I wasn't that great at school. Like, I passed with C's and D's. And I was just not motivated at the time.
Liz says her parents weren't really paying attention.
Like, sometimes your parents don't have any educational background. And so, like, they don't know how to help you. Like, you can pass school with all D's and, like, they wouldn't know it.
She says it felt like they just wanted her to finish high school because that's what you're supposed to do. When they first came to the States, they went to Iowa, but they moved around for years looking for work. Eventually, they decided to join one of Liz's uncles in Seattle. Liz didn't like it.
I hated it. I hated being in Seattle. It's like it rains all the time and there wasn't any other kids around. It's like older people. So we couldn't really go outside. We walked a Safeway all the time for no reason.
For the first 6 months or so, they stayed in a one-bedroom apartment with Liz's uncle and 30 other people. This was early high school. Liz thinks it was that crowded apartment that finally pushed her to get serious about her education.
And so I wanted to get out the house, so I would always be at school, tutoring places, play sports, do anything to just stay at school. So I got really good grades.
Today, Liz lives in Shoreline with her mom and 7 younger brothers and sisters. They have a 5-bedroom house. It's public housing, so rent is just $50 a month, but they're struggling. Her mom is looking for a job, but it's hard because she doesn't speak English.
So basically my whole life I've watched my mom do labor jobs, house cleaning, housekeeping, jobs like that.
They have a big family, and Liz thinks of her cousins almost like brothers and sisters.
Mama, do you take a man down dinner?
When Liz talks to her mom, she switches easily between English and Nuer. Nuer is the southern Sudanese language her family speaks.
My mom's dad had 3 wives. So between her, kati tiga goddamn more than 10
people.
10? She had 10 siblings. My dad had around 10. My mom has 8 children.
Liz's mom grew up in a rural village. She didn't go to school. She never worked outside the home. Liz's life is completely different from what her mom's looked like at that age. For Liz's mom, this is a different world. Liz has to help her mom interpret a lot of everyday life. Rosalind Kaji says she sees this a lot. She's worked with refugee kids for several years and says there's just so much that new arrivals have to learn.
How do you find housing? What are all these crazy processed foods in a grocery store? How does the school system work?
Refugee kids navigating this new system straddle the world of school and the world of their parents.
A lot of our kids go to the school and they're all kind of the foreign refugee kids. And what's interesting is that most of them come from different countries, speak different languages, have a different culture, have a different language. Some of them were on opposite sides of a war, fighting for years, and now they come here and they're best friends and they're hanging out at the youth center together.
Tudor, come here.
Today, Liz is distracting her youngest sister while her mom loads the minivan with clothes for a trip to the laundromat. Liz's dad left 5 or 6 years ago to go back to Sudan, and ever since then, Liz has become almost like a parent to her younger siblings. She goes to their teacher conferences. Now that she's over 18, she doesn't even have to bring her mom. Liz is determined to be the first in her family to graduate from college. Now she just has to convince all 7 of her younger brothers and sisters that they can do it too.
Some of them are not looking so great right now, but I keep pushing them. I have to bribe them, I have to go to parent-teacher conferences, just everything I can do just to try to help them, but sometimes it's not enough.
During her freshman year at Seattle Pacific University, Liz had a couple of her brothers come stay with her on campus for a night to start to get the feel of college. She has 2 more years to go herself, but she's already thinking about the next step. Liz has heard that if you speak English, it's easy to get a job in the newly independent nation of South Sudan. She can't remember anything about life there, but she loves the idea of going back. For KOW, I'm Jessica Partnow.
Still to come, a new study on campus sexual assault says survivors should remain on guard. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1271. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A new study out of the University of Buffalo's Research Institute on Addictions says female college students who survived past sexual assaults are at a much higher risk to become victims again. Station WBFO's Eileen Buckley talks to the principal investigator of the study.
It's never a woman's fault for being victimized. I don't care if she's passed out drunk. I don't care if she's walking naked down the street. It's never, ever, ever her fault for being victimized.
Kathleen Parks is a senior research scientist at UB's RIA. The results of this study say a campus female who was a victim of a past sexual assault is 3 times more likely to have it happen again.
And then the other thing that we've found is when we look at the temporal relationship, so the relationship on a daily level between drinking and victimization, we do find that drinking predicts victimization on a daily level.
The study followed nearly 1,000 college women, mainly 18 to 21 years of age, over a 5-year period. That included their drinking habits, as well as experiences of severe physical and sexual assaults.
So I think what it highlights for us is that looking out for women during those first couple of years is really important. Those are the years when they're most vulnerable.
Past research by Parks shows freshmen have a higher risk of being assaulted if they binge drink. During a recent visit to UB's South Campus in Buffalo, WBFO News spoke with second-year student Megan Messner about freshmen arriving on campus and drinking too much.
It is very scary, and I mean, that's definitely something. Undergrad, grad school, like, it's always going to, you know, you're going to party and you're going to see bad things happening, and it's scary, but you just got to look out for your friends.
With the recent spotlight on campus assaults nationwide, researcher Park says this study shows campuses must be aware of the increased risk.
Women who are so early to come to campuses and experience these horrible things necessarily know how to access the services that would help them avoid PTSD or additional negative experiences or consequences that result from the trauma.
But Parks reiterated that they're not blaming the victim. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
Okay, you've just overthrown your oppressive regime in a successful revolution. Now what? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Can rebel groups form functional political parties after a coup? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Michael Allison, an associate professor of political science at the University of Scranton, traces the transition from military revolution to established administration.
The Civil War in El Salvador ended the same year that I graduated from high school, while the Civil War in Guatemala ended the year that I graduated from college. The settlements that concluded the Salvadoran and Guatemalan wars involved not only an end to armed conflict, but also social, economic, political, and military reforms that would facilitate the transformation of a system based upon violent political conflict to one based upon nonviolent political conflict between competing political parties. The focus of my research is on the transitions of former armed opposition groups to political parties. Looking at the characteristics of the armed group and the environment in which it participates, one can uncover how those factors affect its electoral performance as a new political party. It's interesting also to look at the political performance of groups with few combatants but strong relationships with large nonviolent organizations versus armed groups with many combatants but less contact with nonviolent organizations. After 10 trips to El Salvador and Guatemala to study two former rebel groups, the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front in El Salvador and the Guatemalan National Revolutionary Unit, I have found that some former rebel groups are better prepared for the demands of electoral competition and are more likely to succeed than other rebel groups. Keys to success for former rebels are having large numbers, a political wing in place, good contacts with grassroots organizations, and a unified and coherent organizational structure. It also doesn't hurt if they control territory during the war and are less violent towards civilians. Additionally, I have found that certain institutional environments are more conducive to the success of new political parties than others.
That was Michael Allison of the University of Scranton. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.